And incredibly, we have come to the last case of the day, 23-1464, and that is Jackson versus Methodist Health Services. Okay. And hello, Ms. Hager.
Hello and good afternoon. May it please
Good
the
afternoon.
court? Thank you. My name is Bethany Hager, attorney on behalf of Amanda Jackson, plaintiff and appellant in this case. And thank you for allowing me to be your second COVID mandate case of the day. I got to preview a few of the arguments. I'd like to step back a little bit in that context of COVID-19, excuse me, COVID-19 mandates and go further into some Illinois law and even federal law and remind us that disease mitigation is a public health issue.
Before we do that, looking at appellate procedure 28A6, why shouldn't we dismiss this case for failure to comply with the rule?
Which rule? I'm sorry.
Appellate rule 28A6.
I apologize for any failure to comply with the rules. It was unintentional.
We don't have a back, we don't have the what we need or what's required under the rule to have a sufficient brief in front of us.
The appendix?
There's no background.
I apologize for that. It was unintentional. All right. Disease.
All right. So here's what we have.
All right.
We have the letter attached to the complaint granting Ms. Jackson a permanent exemption from the vaccine requirement. Mm-hmm. And we have the allegations in the complaint referring to a requirement that she either be vaccinated or tested. So can we not assume that the real issue in this case is that the exemption from the vaccine was conditioned on her willingness to submit to regular testing, as opposed to her being denied an exemption?
She alleged in the complaint that while the documented paper given to her before the executive order was issued granted an exemption from vaccine, then she was verbally told later that the exemption would not be honored. And so in the end, her termination, after some back and forth with the employer, her termination was because she did not submit to the vaccination, because that exemption was not honored in the end.
But is there any real dispute that the governor's executive orders allow for a vaccine exemption on religious grounds so long as the individual undergoes regular testing?
So the bigger issue is that it's not the governor's executive order that should have been guiding the party's behavior in this matter. Illinois has a thorough statutory plan for dealing with disease mitigation, which again is a public health issue under United States Supreme Court precedent. And Illinois has thorough statutory precedent in place for how to go about requiring any vaccination or testing that is to be required. One is the public health code.
All I can see in the complaint, okay, as a basis for her objection to testing is that she perceives it to be arbitrary. So I would really be very appreciative if you can tell me, where is there an indication that her objection to testing is one based on her religious beliefs?
There are allegations in the complaint that the testing objection is also based on religious beliefs, stemming from the connection to aborted fetal cells, stemming from the individual right to conscience and determination of personal health and bodily continuity. However, in the larger picture, it is arbitrary to say that because we're either going to require vaccination or we're going to require testing, that's an arbitrary requirement from the employer because, again, Illinois has a statutory scheme in place.
So the reliance
and the
on Illinois law.
Following it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Hager. Finish your thought.
Just that there's a statutory scheme in place. The employer is responsible to follow that, the law that's already in place.
Okay. So when I look at the case and the complaint, it seems pretty clear your client brought a Title VII claim, right? Mm. Is there any claim brought under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
Not in the original complaint, in this one. I think the district court made some allusions to the due process application and 14th Amendment, and so that's why they're addressed in the brief.
Reason I'm asking you that question is because when Ms. Jackson raises points about Illinois law and procedural points about Illinois law in the face of a health crisis or a health pandemic in this situation, the argument can't be that failure to follow Illinois law violates Title VII, correct?
When the executive order comes out, which by the way was his 88th executive order in 18 months regarding COVID, that executive order comes out, there's been this span of time where the Illinois legislature was in session, could have addressed, are we going to somehow amend the health code, amend maybe the influenza vaccine code, amend some other statute to put in place a statutory scheme dealing with COVID-19 vaccines specifically. In that span of time, when those hadn't been done, then you're not dealing with the health crisis necessarily that doesn't allow us to still take those due process measures, which are required by the Illinois Public Health Code. If there is a disease that's not previously addressed by anything else out there and the local health department believes that people need to vaccinate or test for it, there's that process for them to go to court.
So what I'm confused about, though, is Ms. Jackson clearly has brought a Title VII claim. Mm-hmm. The Title VII claim is religious accommodation, correct? It doesn't have anything to do with whether state officials are following or are not following Illinois law.
So because,
is that right?
Because the waters were muddied by not following that process, then you do end up with a Title VII violation because the previous statutory processes and other due process requirements weren't followed. You're going to end up crossing the boundaries of people's Title VII protections when they have spoken up and said, wait a minute, you know, it doesn't, you haven't followed this process, you haven't followed this process, and then they have to fall back on, my conscience won't allow me to go along with this requirement.
Okay, so your point is that the failure to follow Illinois law here is not a violation of the U.S. Constitution. It's a violation of Title VII. It's part of her religious accommodation claim. Is that the point you're making?
In this case, the failure to follow...
It's the only case we're talking about, though, right?
The failure to follow all of that created a context where then plaintiff's Title VII protections were not honored. They almost couldn't be honored because of the context that surrounded everything else that was happening. I have sympathy, I guess, for the position that employers were put in by that context. It would have been very difficult for them to navigate a way to honor...
Can you finish just your train of thought here is how this now comes back under Title VII?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you would just keep going there, because there was a violation mm-hmm. of state law or alleged violation of state law, not following their procedures, how do we get back under Title VII?
So then all of the state procedures that were laid out clearly to follow weren't followed. Now employers and employees are having to navigate how do we handle, there's this requirement employers feel like they're under to make people get the COVID vaccine or to test. But employees are realizing this isn't right, it can't happen. And really the only defense that becomes left to them with regard to their employers to say, my conscience doesn't allow me to go forward with this. And that is when it becomes a Title VII claim or dispute.
But is
that
a social, political, religious?
This plaintiff does have religious objections to the vaccine. She spelled that out to her employer. That's why the documented exemption originally was given to her.
But then we go back to my original question. It seems to me she was opposed to testing.
Yes. Once you state your objection to the vaccine in the workplace and you're given this only other alternative of testing, her conscience could not allow her to follow that path either. There's problems with the testing. There's problems with being singled out in the workplaces. It was known among your coworkers who was vaccinated and who was not, because then you were singled out to have to go for this testing. Everybody knew it. And so that is discriminatory treatment. It's a hostile work environment that's created because she stood up for her religious objection to the vaccine specifically. Now there's this hostile work environment and disparate treatment that she singled out for the testing. Asymptomatic testing, by the way. It's not testing because she has sniffles or a fever or other symptoms. It's you go test every week, every 72 hours, every whatever time period, just because we designate that to be the time period.
And what religious tenet does she rely on for not wanting the testing?
It's the link of the vaccine development has links to aborted fetal cells. And so that link to abortion, which is a violation of her moral beliefs, to participate in or encourage in any way the process of abortion. Okay, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Hello, Mr. Drinkwine.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Drinkwine for Methodist Health Services Corporation. Plaintiff has not stated a Title VII claim for failure to accommodate her religious objection to the COVID-19 vaccination or her objection to COVID testing, and the district court was entirely correct in dismissing count one with prejudice. Plaintiff's first contention is that the district court failed to accept as true her allegation that following the issuance of the governor's executive order, she was told that her religious exemption from the vaccine requirement would not be honored because the administrative order did not allow for such exemptions. The district court gave three reasons why the exhibits to the complaint contradict that allegation. And in its appellee's brief, Methodist argued that those reasons were sound. It's important to note that plaintiff has not filed a reply brief in this case and has therefore waived any responses she could have advanced in opposition to Methodist's arguments. This court recently explained in Bradley v. Village of University Park that an appellant may waive a non-jurisdictional argument by failing to respond in a reply brief to new arguments raised by the appellee. Putting the waiver aside, the district court gave three reasons for finding the contradiction. The religious exemption is permanent. The governor's executive order specifically states that religious exemptions would be honored. And the executive order states that unvaccinated healthcare workers must comply with weekly COVID testing, not that they will be placed on unpaid leave or excluded from the healthcare facility. So the district court did not err in failing to accept as true plaintiff's allegation that her exemption from the vaccination was revoked.
Did that executive order carry, I guess, the force of state law?
The executive order carried the force of state law. Methodist was required to follow its directives. Absolutely, Your Honor. So
if you had not, what would be the result?
Well, I suppose there was all manner of liability that could have been. There's cases in the Seventh Circuit that talk about putting the employer on the razor's edge of liability when it's required to violate the law. And if she were to work in an unvaccinated, untested state, she would, as a nurse, she would be exposed to patients and so forth. And, you know, perhaps one of them would have a claim against Methodist for allowing her to continue to work in her unvaccinated, untested state. But it's also important to recognize in this case that, you know, whether the allegation that she had her religious exemption to testing revoked or not isn't that important, because whether or not she had the religious exemption to the vaccine, she would have had to test anyway. And she has alleged that she has a religious objection to both the vaccine and testing, and that she would not take those under any circumstances. So vaccine exemption or no vaccine exemption, she would have remained unvaccinated. And the governor's executive order establishes that plaintiff's religious objection to the vaccine was reasonably accommodated by allowing her to test. Whether she had the exemption or not, she would have been required to test. Plaintiff has also alleged that her objection to the testing is religious in nature, and she in fact refused the testing, which then led to the requirement that she be excluded from Methodist healthcare facility under the terms of the executive order, which necessitated her termination. So plaintiff's own allegations, together with the terms of the executive order, contradict her allegation that she was terminated for refusing the vaccine.
What do we do with the argument, though, by Methodist complying kind of with the executive order, transformed this private actor into a public actor?
Well, that can't be the law, Your Honor, because anytime anyone followed the law, they would be transformed into a public actor for purposes of a constitutional claim, 1983 or otherwise. I can't see how that could be the law. So,
well, there's no, I don't see any reference at all to the U.S. Constitution in the verified complaint.
Well, she uses the words due process, but I agree that
no, right. It seems right, but Ms. Hager articulated that the due process violation, if we want to call it that, is part of the substantive Title VII failure to accommodate claim. In other words,
from a Methodist standpoint, they're simply following the governor's executive order that they have to follow, and that argument, the due process argument, is really challenging the executive order, not. Methodist has no inclination or ability to defend the due process, whether the executive order complies with due process or not. They simply have to follow it as an employer subject to it in the state of Illinois.
So in other words, there's a subject matter jurisdiction problem with traceability on Article III standing, because Methodist Hospital doesn't enforce the executive order. The governor of Illinois does.
The governor of Illinois promulgates and issues it, and everybody in the state of Illinois has to follow it. Yes.
There's no supplemental jurisdiction invoked in the amendment. I've tried to figure out the due process claim. I can't figure it out because there's also no invocation of 28 U.S.C. 1367, the supplemental jurisdiction statute, because I thought possibly it's a state law claim of some kind.
Well, that's what I thought, Your Honor, I read it as such. It's specifically under Section 2 of the, if we're talking about Count 3, it's expressly under Section 2 of the Illinois Department of Public Health Act, and there's several reasons why the district court was correct in dismissing Count 3. First, the Illinois Appellate Court in Moore v. Lumpkin, which is at 258 Illap 3rd, 980, page 998, held that there's no private right of action under Section 2 of the Illinois Department of Public Health Act, the section that plaintiffs brings that count under. And going to the question, due process rights afforded to citizens under this act or any other, that's a protection afforded to them against conduct by government actors, not by private actors like Methodist. Well, there are circumstances where a private actor can become a state actor for due process purposes. None are alleged in this complaint.
Can I go back to, Judge Rovner has always had started with a good question. Could I circle back to get your perspective on it? And that
sure.
Was, I'll put it in my words. In my view, the complaint is quite thin on allegations about testing violating religious convictions. What's the most specific allegation you can think of in the complaint on testing?
There isn't one. I share the view that she hasn't adequately alleged a sincere religious objection based on testing. Now, on the vaccination, we gave her that exemption. That's not really an issue. But on testing, there's no religious objection to it per se. And I don't follow the whole thing with the stem cells and so forth. So our position is that's not adequately pled because she hasn't pled. In fact, she's pled a health reason or a fairness reason, not a religious reason. And she also hasn't alleged that she made her religious objection to testing known to Methodists, well, if she has one. And that's another problem. But an even bigger point on that is, even if she had, Your Honor, alleged a violation, failure to accommodate her religious objection to testing, Methodists wouldn't be required to break the law in order to provide an accommodation. And that's where we urge the court to follow or adopt the reasoning of the district court in the Goodrich case, where the court acknowledged that undue hardship is ordinarily an affirmative defense, which is not a basis for dismissal, but it cited Seventh Circuit authority for the exception to that rule, where it's clear that the plaintiff's claim is barred as a matter of law. And the court found it barred as a matter of law because it would have to accommodate, the accommodation of no testing would require it to violate the law. And it relied on a Ninth Circuit opinion in Sutton v. Providence St. Joseph Medical Center and a Sixth Circuit opinion in Yeager v. First Energy Generation Corp, where Title VII claims were dismissed on 12b6 motions because the defendant established that a religious accommodation would cause the employer undue hardship by requiring it to violate the law. And in the Goodrich case, of course, it's the same governor's executive order at issue, and they specifically found that allowing the worker to go to work that's unvaccinated without testing would be an unreasonable accommodation because it would require them to violate the law. And there's one more point, if you'd indulge me. There's another alternate ground that this court could affirm the district court on as far as the dismissal of count one goes. The first element of any Title VII failure to accommodate religion is a sincere religious belief that conflicts with an employment requirement. The Sixth Circuit in Yeager talked about the courts using different analysis to get to the point of concluding that you don't have to violate the law to reasonably accommodate them. And one line of authority is that they've reasoned that an obligation imposed by law is not an employment requirement. And if this court were to agree with that, the law within the executive order requiring healthcare workers to be vaccinated and unvaccinated workers to be tested would negate the first element of plaintiff's Title VII claim altogether. And this court held in Thompson v. Illinois Department of Health Professional Regulation, which is at 300 F3rd 750, page 754, that where a plaintiff attaches documents and relies upon documents to form the basis for a claim or part of a claim, dismissal is appropriate if the document negates that claim. So if the obligation imposed by law is not an employment requirement, the directives in the executive order negate the first element of plaintiff's Title VII claim. And if this court were inclined to affirm the district court's dismissal of count one, it could on that alternative basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that it? Yes. It is. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Ms. Hager. Ms. Hager used all of her time, but give her 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. The defendant's position is that the executive order has the force of law and they had to follow it. And that is why we have this discussion of the due process context around that executive order, because the executive order cannot be state law. That's the Youngstown site that's in our brief. Executive orders cannot change law. They are not state law. They don't have the force of law. They're executive orders only. Law is made through the legislature. So if the executive order was a law, it still has a due process problem by not giving an exemption from the testing requirement, which was a thought out process in the Illinois Public Health Code. Whether it's vaccine, testing, any medical process, you must afford the due process to the person who wants to refuse the receipt of that medical process. So even if you're going to give the executive order the force of law, which Supreme Court precedent says we should not, then it still has a due process problem by not including that exemption for testing. You're going to have those problems when the executive branch steps into the purview of the legislative branch in these times of crisis. And I want to leave you with the Supreme Court citation from number 22-592. It's a May 2003 United States Supreme Court decision, early enough that we have the volume number 598, but not the page number from it. And Justice Gorsuch made this statement. Since March, it's Arizona v. Mayorkas. Since March 2020, we may have experienced the greatest intrusions on civil liberties in the peacetime history of this country. And then he goes through a litany of executive officials issuing emergency decrees on various issues throughout the country. Fear and the desire for safety are powerful forces. A leader or an expert who claims he can fix everything if only we do exactly as he says can prove an irresistible force. The concentration of power in the hands of so few may be efficient and sometimes popular, but it does not tend toward sound government. If emergency decrees promise to solve some problems, they threaten to generate others. And I would posit that is exactly what happened here in the case of Executive Order Number 88. It promised to solve some problems, but it overstepped its bounds and created a host of others for employees and employers across the state of Illinois. And by rule, says Justice Gorsuch, by indefinite emergency edict risk, and ruling by indefinite emergency edict risks leaving all of us with a shell of a democracy and civil liberties just as hollow. In this instance, Ms. Jackson articulated her religious objection to medical procedures of vaccination and testing, and under Title VII, in any ordinary case, her employer would have needed to honor that objection and give her an exemption. And in the cases my colleague noted earlier of the influenza vaccine in Illinois, these exemptions were routinely granted before COVID, routinely. All the employee had to do was state, my conscience won't allow me to go along with this. And the employer recognized that and gave the exemption. And Illinois law has a fallback whereby if there is another health risk or something else coming along, then we can address it by asking that employee to go through some other processes. But just because it was COVID-19 and a pandemic and fear came in, people overstepped their bounds, made this context where we now do have violation of protection of rights under Title VII. And I would ask this court to protect those rights and send this case back to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hager. Thank you, Mr. Drinkwine. Case will be taken under advisement. This court